Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Karen Graves, Head of Operations, EMEA Hub.
We're a group of people who use technology and things every single day, and it's like, you know, such a part of our lives now. But yeah, none of us actually know how it works, like, realistically. Well, some of us do, but not very many people do. And, like, that is a whole, like, that's never really happened on that kind of level before. Like, people don't understand, like, the fundamentals of, like, development or the internet or what even it is. Like, if someone was, like, explain what Wi-Fi is and how we're connected to it, or explain the internet and, like, how it works, like, not many people could probably articulate that particularly well. I think they'd be able to, you know, maybe draw some kind of metaphoric kind of description about kind of what it's like, or, like, probably would go down the road of, like, the purpose for it and how people use it. But, like, to actually, what is it? What is, like, and I think that's why that generation struggles with it, because it's sort of like they're so used to things being things and physical. You can touch it, you can grab it, you know? And, like, now we have all these things that we're so reliant on, but no one could necessarily, like explain it that well. And I think that's probably where, like, part of it comes from. And
I think that's right. You can apply that to all sorts of things, that sort of increase in technology. I think most of us just accept, and certainly older people, and I count myself in that section, would just accept that things do what they do these days. We don't know how they work. So I remember when I was young and used to go out to grandparents or uncles or whatever, and you'd get in a car and you weren't actually sure you were going to get there. Somebody would check the oil, you know, tires, blah, blah, blah. And there was always that element of uncertainty that you'd either get to where you're going or you'd get back okay, because things were much more practical and people understood more how they worked, I think, if you use that car analogy. Now, we just get in our cars, we use a fingerprint to start them up. We're talking now about having driverless cars, which is just a huge step, really, and so many things associated with that that people have to consider before the practical side of actually having a driverless car gets out on the road. That kind of thing, of that uncertainty in our lives about just that practical thing, has gone away, and we don't really understand why. It just has. And that's happened with everything, hasn't it? You know, those things that were unreliable or that you had to replace, you might upgrade things these days, but you don't necessarily have that same level of understanding of how they work or how they do what they do. We just accept that they do what they do.
Yeah. 100%, and even at, like, a really low level. So, like, when I was in university, like, my degree was economics. When we were kind of viewing various equations for economics, like, I don't feel that we had as good of a grasp of the understanding of, like, the reason for the sums and, like, how they work, because we had, like, financial calculators that I would just use. Like, you know, or, like, in finance class, you, like, calculate, like, compound interest, like, so that was just really easy to plug into the calculator, right? But, like, when my lecturer was doing it, like, her fundamental understanding of it seemed to me to be at a high level. But this is kind of the point, I suppose, where I kind of think that there's benefits associated with it, and this is why I think the world's kind of moved in that direction, because although, like, her fundamental understanding, she would have spent months, like, learning how to do those calculations, where we just did them and then understood, like, the purpose behind, you know, figuring out a macroeconomic trend, for example. Yeah. Like, we'd just understand that better and have that kind of clarity of thought, because we wouldn't have to waste time doing those things, right? So because they're just they're just there. And it's a good and it's a good and a bad thing, because you know, you don't, it's good because you progress faster, you get down to like what is the actual purpose, right? You know, I think that like we're so much more purpose orientated and driven now, and like I think that, you know, the opportunity to be creative and think up things is like never been so easy before. But you know, the fundamentals and our understanding of things have shifted, and you know, that causes volatility in certain aspects, but I think for the most part it's obviously really good. And you know, we just have to rely on technical people who are way smarter than I am to handle these things. So it's an interesting kind of way that people think about things and the dynamics and how we interact. I think that I'm all for, like, you know, creative thought. And I was actually wanting to ask this like before we start the show as well, but you know, understanding like why people do things, like, I think is such an interesting question, and like a topic that, like, I actually think about quite a lot. It's like people, like, London's my favorite example of this, and I'm just gonna veer off on a slight tangent, but like London's my absolute favorite example of this. So when I used to like walk around London, everyone looked busy, right? Every single person was like running around, looked busy, like that hustle. And I quite appreciate the hustle, because it's like this energy, like, that you can feed off it. It's quite, you know, and it's like, we're all going and doing this stuff. We're all going to work. Look at us. Like, we're all charging towards the office, right? In like, in huge numbers. And I just sort of like always would think, it's like, I'm such a people watcher. I'm sure like a lot of people are, certain, but I would just like be watching people and be thinking like, why are they doing what they're doing? Like, and it always made me think like, what is the intent behind like why they're working hard at something? And you were saying, like, you know, when we spoke last week, I think it was, that we were talking about like the interest in millennials. It's like, why are we actually doing what we want to do? And it kind of rolls in nicely into that. And I think millennials are interesting in that, like, they really do think about like why they're actually doing something much more than I think prior generations kind of did stuff because that was what you were supposed to do. And they didn't really, you know, we talk about having a fundamental understanding of like what's going on. Well, let's get a fundamental understanding about why we're actually doing stuff and how we feel about that.
That's right. Yeah, I think it, yeah, go on, sorry, Andy, carry on.
Exactly, and I think that's why we look at, like, you know, we want to talk a little bit about millennials, like we look at them, and I think that that's one thing that they're absolutely starting to nail, is like understanding why we're actually doing stuff. Like, why are we doing stuff?
Well, I think that's a really, that, oh God, that could cover so many areas. But I think, you know, when we spoke last week, one of the things that I do, you know, I do try and do myself is if I can, is adopt some of the millennial, Gen Z, whatever you want to call it, viewpoints, because I think, A, they get a bit of a bum rap quite a lot of the time as being seen in a generalistic way as just always on their phones, not really paying attention, but and therefore less thoughtful and less considered about what they want to do. I just think possibly the concept of going to work, as my parents and grandparents went to work and yours did, and as I have done so far in my career, is that you leave home and you go to work. I actually think with the tools that we have available and the way millennials and Gen Z use these tools in, that are a very natural part of their lives, I think that potential is that they're always at work, and that we need to change our views about what that working environment is like. And that's really challenging, I think, when you've got businesses that have been established for a number of years and they've got, particularly from a cultural aspect, and you kind of get culture. It's a hard thing to change, and it kind of gets ingrained somehow in the company, and it's a very hard thing to try and unpick and unravel and change that culture of a company. But I do think we could learn a lot from millennials and Gen Zs, or whatever they're terming them, you know, these iGen or whatever these days, because I think they have a much better work-life balance view than possibly, certainly than I do, and I think certainly than a lot of my colleagues do, that take great value in being seen to come to work. And actually, is that something that's quite self-important, that drives you to be seen to be coming to work, seen to be hurrying somewhere? Whereas actually, you know, if we looked at the way young people use technology these days, I think we can learn from that and potentially make our lives a bit easier, because I think this concept of being at work is very different, because I think we're always at work. I don't have set working hours. I work for a company that's it's a global company. We're in, how many? We've got 160 locations. We're in 160 countries. We've got 37 locations across the globe in some form or another in our actual offices, although we have other contact people as well. So we've got a really wide distribution base, and the time zones are quite challenging if you want to have a meeting that includes the US and Singapore and ourselves here in London. And even the 1 hour time between ourselves and my colleagues in Paris can be a bit interesting sometimes. So that idea of using technology differently, because I don't have those set working hours necessarily. And so this idea of being at work, I think, is very different. And that's where I think we could learn from the way younger people today view the ability to be at work. And do they want to be stuck in an office every day like I have been, if we've got the tools to be more flexible and actually have a better work-life balance? And that kind of links in with culture. And I think they're quite thoughtful about the kind of companies they want to work for as well, that maybe have more of a green aspect to them, or some kind of social, corporate social responsibility element. And I think that's all part of the way that they view their lives, and they've got all of these tools at their disposal that I try and utilize, as a 50-year-old, I try and utilize because I think it helps me. I'm running I've got coming up in the middle of September, a speed mentoring evening, where we've got some from the industry I work in, some quite significant market people coming along to be mentors for an evening, spend 10 minutes with somebody, then you move on. People come on with a particular question, but we've got five reverse mentors to come and do that for us. So we're going to say to, people like me, older people, we've got five, under 25-year-olds who have just started working in this industry, either graduate trainees or, just come in to start on the IT side of the business, come and talk to them and ask them questions about what they want to see from business, how they use their working environment, how could we adapt our businesses? Because I think it's really interesting and that we can, we ought to be incorporating. It's not just the tools. It's not just the actual physical tools. It's the way you use the tools and how they're part of your life. And they're not always necessarily a bad thing. I think it's, and that it's irritating when you're sitting at dinner and somebody's on their phone and I have to stop myself from doing that. So I'm no worse than they are. So I just think it's a really interesting mindset, and this concept of going to work is probably getting to be really outdated. And I think people generally view themselves, they are at work because they've got the tools on their phone, on their iPad or whatever it is, to actually be at work whenever they need to be at work.
Yeah, well, it was interesting that the perceived notion of work, well, actually the 9-to-5 was actually introduced by Henry Ford in the Ford plant. So that's the reason why everyone works 9-to-5.
It's how we base our day, and whether it may not be relevant anymore.
Of a car manufacturer who brought out the F1, which I think was in 1900 or something like that. So it's that's still the practices we have today. And as you were saying that the perceived notion of work, right? Well, what is work? Define work. I think most people, when they think of work, it's not supposed to be even though people don't admit it, but it's not supposed to be a fun thing. It's supposed to be something that you go in, you work hard, yeah. You do, you earn your comeuppance. But I perceive it differently, and I think you do too, in that work, I don't even like the term necessarily of work. It's I think was it Richard Branson who said it's not work, it's life. It's not work-life balance, it's life or something. That should be kind of the extension. And I just think that work is a horrible term. I think it's about what have you achieved today? What have you done? You are employed by someone to get a job done, right? And that's what you should be trying to get done, is get it done. Does it matter how you get it done? I mean, I don't think so, but I think that's how we need to view things, is what have you achieved? when I go, and it kind of brings on to the next bit, but when I go into a new project, or, you know, my background's in startups, so if I was like approaching a new startup, you know, it was, well, what's the goal here? When I heard about the project, like, what did I envision myself going in and achieving, and what did success look like for me on a personal level, right? And that's what I wanted to achieve out of it, and that was what I said I would do, and I went in and did it. I didn't go in and say that I would necessarily be there for 40 hours and I would say yes sir, no sir. Like, why is that important? You know, it's about going in and like achievements at the end of the day, and being innovative and pushing things forward. And from, you know, a macro perspective, for even like from a company-wide perspective, like, that's what matters, doesn't it? It's not necessarily about like which company works the longest hours. Like, who cares, right? I mean, why does that matter? It's about like what country's doing what. And, you know, if there's a secret formula out there, then I'm sure everyone would be doing it. But I don't think there is. I think everyone's kind of bespoke. And, you know, having that freedom to work in the capacity that you know is best. And that might be working 9 to 5. You know, working from home might not mean that you're the most productive. You know, for me, like, working 100% from home probably wouldn't work. But like the odd day here and there is actually like probably optimal for me. Some people it might be not at all. Some people it might be full on. Like, it just depends. But like, why are we kind of hindering that? And as you said, it's a really good example on the things that you're doing, where it's kind of when you're bringing in these like under 25 year olds, asking them about things and like actually learning. And like, I talk quite a lot about that on the show, about, you know, getting that external feedback and actually having those fresh set of eyes and being hungry to hear what they have to say. Like, getting outside of the bubble, it's really important. And so I'm really a big fan that kind of you guys are taking that on board. And, you know, kind of bespoking this idea of kind of work. It's about achievements, whether it's selfish or not, as long as it aligns with, you know, you're essentially shaking hands with an organization saying, I want to do this for you. And if they agree that that sounds like a great idea, then you just have to, should just have to go get it done.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that sort of coming out of that. I think every company has its strategic objectives, whether it's a new startup, whether it's one like mine, it's a global reinsurance company. And I think the type of industry you're in can sort of affect how you might want to choose to adapt your operational working practices to reflect perhaps a different viewpoint or a more flexible view of how people could work. So I think I agree with you that it is about what people do, and it's about understanding what the company strategy is. It's understanding how you contribute to that. And then if there is a different way of you contributing to that, then I think it's something that companies can consider. We are in a business where we use brokers, so we need locations where we can be visited by brokers to bring business to us. And so there is an element of certain aspects of my business need to be in a location. They need to have support staff around them that need to be there to assist them when they're seeing the brokers, for example. And so the people in those kind of roles do have like a fixed way of working. You know, there are key hours they need to be around in the underwriting room, etc., so that the brokers can come and visit them. So there is structure around their day, but the associated support around that, from IT, from a risk management perspective, from project management, could be handled very differently. It doesn't necessarily need to be based in an office in the middle of London, which is a hugely expensive location to be in. It could be handled differently, and I think it's getting people to access. Accept that you know, being in a place, everybody being in the same place, isn't necessarily the way of working going forward, although there ought to be elements that maybe are fixed and that have to be there. But people take great comfort in, you know, I from a personal example, I hate working from home. I really hate it. I'm the world's worst work from home there is. So if anyone from my company actually ever listens to this, they're like, we're never going to let Karen work from home, because I just, you know, I actually quite enjoy I find work very social, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, people come into work and so on. I actually do think work should be I know that's not always the case, but I think hopefully most people at some point throughout their day, with social interaction, it is a social It is a social thing to do, and it should also have some element of fun about it. Work is serious, and we take that seriously, but our environment and the things that we can do and have access to and connect with colleagues should have an element of fun about it, I think. Else it's just, why do you want to come into work at all? So we've been trying, to as well as utilise IT solutions more in terms of being able to communicate effectively with people in other parts of the globe regarding our industry. Because a lot of my colleagues here in London often manage people that are based in Hong Kong. They might have a team of people. One of my colleagues has a team of 50 people, and they're just scattered around everywhere. And so managing them effectively, we do utilize IT solutions as best we can for that cloud. We have some great IT development going on in terms of being able to do business and hook up with colleagues and create almost that virtual office feeling, even though we are a company that people need to come and see. But it's actually, I think as well, it's that flexibility of working out if a job can be done differently, and then working out if people are happy to do that job differently. I mean, I would hate it if I had to work from home every day. I would just drive myself insane, because I like a bit. I think work is a social, is also a very social. The social elements to it are quite great, I think. Every company is going to be different, clearly, and it's working out which elements of your business you could tackle differently, and then that change mindset, because this work-life balance thing is, as I've got older, I've realised is more important. Interestingly enough, I actually enjoy working, so I probably have a very bad work-life balance, but that's a choice, and so I'm quite happy with that choice, if you see what I mean. I probably feel my work-life balance is okay. Other people look at it and go, no, it's not. But I think it works for me. But that view of working and being able to manage your downtime better is something I think that we could learn from millennials, for example, about the way they view doing business and let that have a positive impact. And I don't think I think people are very rigid in their thinking and don't always want to accept that there is a different way of doing things. Or actually, a bunch of young people below the age of 24 or whatever it might be can actually give them an insight into a way of doing things better. But I just think they do it naturally. And we need to challenge ourselves about looking at the way they do things.
Yeah, and it's like organizational structure or organizational management, people management. I just think they're synonymous, and I think they have to change with each other, right? So it's like, I always would say that the people comes first, and I think that it's not always the case. But like you say, as the people are changing, having that fundamental understanding about what their desires are, what they actually want to get out of things, what the intent is, like, you can't really change the organizational side until you have managed the people side. And that's certainly my view on things. And I think that maybe some people would echo that, maybe not, I don't know. But I think that's the important bit here, is the fundamental understanding of people, and let them kind of dictate the organizational structure as much as possible. And I think it is something that's constantly evolving.
It's also a trust element as well. I work for global company, and you see lots of cultural differences that are just that there's no reason they just are there. So in the UK, I think we have a very, we are very open to being flexible about the way people work. In other countries, it can be very different. That it's that view that if you're not in the office, then are you really working? It's just a step to get people over. And I think at some point it'll all balance out, and seeing the way that we do things in the UK here and in the US, other parts of our company may then begin to see, well, we can be more flexible and it does actually work. And that way you get to retain talent, because, particularly, I think certainly for women, we often move roles to find a more accommodating job that fits in with what our key drivers are at a particular time. And so I think you can get to retain talent if you're more flexible, but it's not something that comes naturally, because it's just not part of a normal country's working style. But I do think sort of this whole, I think the internet and the internet of things is flattening things out. And so I think that change will happen. It's just happening at different places, at a pace in different places. So I hope, you know, but certainly for us in our industry here in London on the insurance and reinsurance side, not just talking about my company, but generally, our talent pool of people coming in is coming from a very different place than it used to. And so, you know, that very traditional way into a business is not there anymore. And our potential talent is coming from a much different base of young people with different skills. And I think, you know, we have to adapt ourselves to understanding how to employ them as colleagues and how to best bring them on board and utilize their skills, because it's going to be very different going forward, which is a great thing, actually. But that's been something that's been noted in various research that's gone on lately, is that, you know, the talent pool is, we're going to have to find it from different places. We may just need to think differently about how we hire that talent, particularly if we're moving into a world that's, you know, a lot of industries have been hit by disruptors, the financial service industry in particular, when you've got sort of people setting up, you know, looking at giving loans in a different way, looking at, you know, just the apps that you can get now, the way that people view banking, or the ability to, you know, to buy goods is different. And so our industry has sort of lagged behind a little bit on that. But we have got disruptors now that are just insuring in different ways and offering insurance in different ways, you know, using mobile phones, targeting people, looking at very specific things, rather than offering blanket coverage for something. My company doesn't necessarily, you know, we don't do any personalized business, so we don't deal with motor or homeowners at all. We're in sort of much bigger, probably in casualty risks. We have a big life division that provides life cover to companies on a company level. But we do things like satellite insurance, big construction risks, look at insuring the Olympic Park, for example. So we're in that space. But in the sort of, you know, the direct space to me and to you as a consumer in the UK for motor insurance or home insurance, it potentially be very different going forward. Do you have to buy a yearly policy for your car going forward? Couldn't you just buy it when you need to drive your car? You know, that kind of rigid structure is going to be challenged at some point by people coming into the insurance sector and disrupting it and offering products for us that will be much very beneficial to us. You know, why are we insuring our car now? I'm not driving it. You know, it's parked at home. Why am I paying for 365 days of cover when I might use it 100 days? So people are coming in and using technology to be able to develop those kind of products is really interesting. It might be, you know, you can do it from your phone, have a tracker installed on your phone, and, you know, and you could potentially just pay for the mileage and the insurance cover that you use, or estimate it, and then you adjust it each month for the amount of premium you might have to pay. It's a very interesting concept that disruptive element is coming into an industry which is very traditional, and will, you know, it won't affect the business that we do, but it will affect us as consumers in the way that we might be able to buy products for our home cover or our car insurance might be very different than it is now. And I think that's, you know, that's something, and for that to happen, it requires people to think differently, use the technology, and that's where, you know, the talent of young people who don't have those barriers around the traditional way of doing things can come in and potentially really have an impact on the industry. And I think that's fantastic, actually.
Well, I think so. I think so. And I mean, like you were talking about there, I think we've actually had talked with quite a few people who I've looked at similar projects. You know, it's all on kind of the data side, you know, kind of collaborating with it's called blockchain technologies, along with like augmented AI and data. So like, yeah, I mean, all these things are here, and it's subject to change. And I think that it's the approach, you know, and how you approach things now, I think, which is differentiates you. I think a productive and a positive way approaching things now is going in with an open mind and willingness to actually change things. That's a healthy approach, because you can't sleep anymore. You can't sleep on things anymore. You have to be adaptable. You have to be agile. You know, there's methodologies in place now, so that's allowing people to be agile So it's having that kind of mentality and approach to things, which as much as like the technical capabilities, is a differentiator. And my kind of thing is as well, a little bit off topic, but people panic about technical abilities now, or technical skills, learning that, learning how to code and all kind of the rest of it. But I actually think that most people will be in good stead as long as you approach things appropriately. You know, I think that, you know, we were talking last time about, you know, Jordan Spieth, and he just won the Open. And
yeah,
like he had an approach, like he had a strategy going in there that he had the skills to execute on, right?
Yeah.
But that yeah. was the differentiator, is the approach that he'd taken. And you can always, and if you take a sensible approach to things, you're going to get the results more often than not. And I think that that's one thing that I think you bear in mind. When I talk with technical hiring managers, for example, like they look at technical people now, and it's like, yeah, as long as people understand the fundamentals, like we're not as concerned about them having to learn another language. So what we look for is people who kind of understand and have an innate vision and fundamental understanding and approach things in the right manner. That's what really matters. So, overlooking things, it's... that's what you have to hold true to yourself. And I'm sure you've, throughout your career, I'm sure you can look back and think, you know, I've always approached things after I kind of had that learning curve in a certain way. And that's really been what's held me true. You know, all the kind of nuanced skills here and there, you know, they're subject to change, of course. But, you know, if your approach is correct, you'll get through things regardless of kind of the business and the organization.
I think that's true, and I'll quickly talk about that as well, because I, you know, when I first started working up in the city here in an office, you know, we didn't have, you know, I can remember computers coming in and we had Wang machines, which is like going back years and years, and you know, and it's been a massive change, but the positive impact on the business has been incredible. It's like sort of you talking earlier about the calculators. You accept that they do what they do. You don't have to waste that time now in trying to actually do the very difficult calculations to get to a point before you can do the next bit. And the fundamental change in how we use data, collect data, has given us a real understanding of our business. And when we look at perhaps where our risks sit across the globe, we can understand, you know, what all our risks are across different books of business, all in one particular area. That gives us a massive intellectual ability to look at what we might charge to insure that piece of business and understand what our downside risk is if something was to happen in that particular area, whether it's California with an earthquake or whether it's another tsunami in Japan, you know, whatever. We are very much driven more by natural catastrophes than we are driven by stock market up and downs. We are a company that provides cover to people on physical things, and we want to know where they're located, and this ability to understand where our risks sit and then how they interact with each other is just huge. It's absolutely huge, and it's had a massive effect on the industry. But just going back to Jordan Spieth, I did read something yesterday where a psychologist had looked at his behaviour and sort of said what he believed he was able to do was to, from his mindset, was to not look back. He was able to park what had just happened to him. And because he had so much to do at that particular point in time, and it took him 70 minutes or whatever it was to, you know, find somewhere to drop the ball, go back, work out what he was going to do, he was so involved in the moment that he forgot about what had just happened to him to get him in that position. So he dealt with his problems and moved forward, and he didn't spend that time dwelling on what had just happened to him, and it enabled him to move forward. And I think that's quite, you know, that we often spend a lot of time looking back and thinking, oh God, I shouldn't have done that. And actually, I think what he did, because he got wrapped up in the moment of solving his problem and moving, and he moved forward. And I think that affected, that meant his mindset going forward was just about achieving what he wanted to achieve and winning the competition without letting that horror on the 13th hole affect the rest of his round. And I think that's quite a, you know, for such a young person, that's really incredible thinking to actually be able to think your way through a problem like that and move forward. I just thought it was phenomenal mental resilience. You know, no matter what age you are, it's great to watch. And I know my son, who's the same age as Spieth, it was just insane. You know, wow, what a you know, real role model moment. It was just amazing to watch him.
But it's right. It's reducing that lag, isn't it? I think, like you say, it's a great example, and there's always going to be a lag in, you know, something that didn't go right, because you have to briefly look back at it and figure out how to not do that again, right? So whatever that is, in Speed's case, it's obviously swing adjustment, but, like, you know, you can do that in business, and I do think that it's a great point. I think there's so many organizations and teams or whatever that take things that have gone bad and spend so much time analyzing what went bad. It's like, right, let's make quick adjustments and move forward. Like, and it's about reducing that lag period moving on.
And blame as well. I think blame can come into that. And we sometimes like to want to, you know, assuming it's not, you know, somebody's not doing anything criminal. We all make decisions based on the facts in front of us. And at that time, it feels like the right decision to make. Maybe in, you know, 24 hours time, you think, oh, well, you know, I had to make the decision then. I would, you know, with hindsight, I mean, hindsight's a great thing. And I think sometimes companies and individuals, and I've certainly done this in the past, we beat ourselves up about making a decision and then thinking, I wish I'd never done that, or I should have done it differently. But actually, at the time, you're making a decision that you believe is right. I do think that. And I think you can adjust your behaviour going forward and think, right, I'm never going to get myself in that position again. Or, you know, I'm going to make sure that when I next take a decision like that, this was an element I hadn't considered before, a factor that I hadn't realised was going to affect this decision. But when I make the next one, I'll remember to incorporate that in my thinking and then move on and don't keep dwelling on it. I think as individuals, we have a sense of wanting to beat ourselves up sometimes about stuff. And I think, that's something I know that I've certainly done. And but moving back to sort of seeing change, you know, I moved down to London when I was 18 from Leicester, and have ended up staying here. And I've seen sort of working through the 80s, and there's been some massive changes to the business. I've always been in this industry in one area or another, in the reinsurance insurance side. And it's seen some huge changes, both from a technological point of view, which has massively enabled us to inform our business. It also opens up to a whole new range of risks, by the way, which I'll just touch upon in a minute. But it's really, you know, the ability to communicate quickly and well and understand what risks you are covering and what goes into that risk, where they're located. It's such a huge step to enable us to understand our business that we are now very considered and very creative as an industry in terms of products that we can offer companies to take advantage of. And, you know, from that has come and sometimes with that rapid change, it's been hugely fast, particularly over the last 10 years or so. We've not necessarily adjusted our thinking about the way we require very traditional companies in this market. We have an interest in Lloyd's of London, which has been going for 300 years, etc. We have a business in there. You know, it's very, they've done a marvellous job, actually, of really adapting their view of life about how they provide cover and offer the ability to take risk. And we are still trying to improve our industry in terms of operational processes and using technology more effectively and communicating with different parts of the market, brokers, underwriters, loss adjusters, claims, however it might be, in how we, because we all share a risk in this market, so how we, you know, we may have 20 people that's providing cover on a particular risk, how we communicate with each other, how the brokers communicate with all of us, is something that we've struggled with. And I think we're finally getting there, but we are starting to look at the way fintech companies do things. And I think that technological advances will keep benefiting the way that we do things. We will still be a marketplace that needs brokers because our risks are complicated. And it needs that link with a broker and a client to the underwriter to help explain and really manage somebody's risk exposures and work with them. So it's a change of lens, really. And that's been something that we've been playing catch up with. And we haven't necessarily adapted the way that we can employ people or the way that we can incorporate them into our businesses. You know, it's It's a bit of a gap there. And I think we need to work out how we fill that gap intellectually and culturally, because the people we're going to be employing are very different than the people we employed 20 years ago, which had a much more traditional view of what they expected from a working environment. So it's very interesting, seeing those changes has been really interesting. And I've, you know, in terms of technology myself, it's right that, you know, I've never been required to code or anything like that, but I have been a user of technology in an office since it first came out, really. And it's just, I love it. I absolutely love being able to, you know, use new things, take on new technology. I just think it's fantastic. Everybody feels the same, and sort of keeping track of that, you know, it's sort of, we sort of acquire skills without realizing we've acquired them, I think, sometimes. I would use my mum as an example. You know, she's a, you know, an 85-year-old silver surfer, God love her. So, you know, it's you know, whereas my dad won't go near them, but I think, you know, if you're willing to be quite open about something, and things are quite simple these days when you look at them, it's kind of like click here, do that, type something, you know, the ability to use technology, you can acquire those skills quite quickly. And I think as I've gone through sort of 26 or however many years working up in this particular bit of town, you acquire skills and they kind of seep into your consciousness without you really realizing it. And you just, I can't think of a time when anybody's actually sat me down and said, this is how you turn something on. You kind of work it out and you kind of move forward. Do you know what I mean? You sort of, you acquire skills along the way, and you acquire the skills at the level that you need them, I think. And it's very much a choice as to how much you want to embrace technology or not embrace it. And also in your personal life as well. I do enjoy technology and the way that it can make your life easier. You know, I think it's brilliant. And I just think we need to incorporate the good bits of it into the way that our businesses can effectively improve their processes, and also hire really good people with a slightly different start on life. But the technology side has actually given rise to, I mean, you see it in the papers every day when you talk about cyber risk, etc. That's given rise, you know, this wonderful ability to do things, and the interconnectedness of the world that we live in has also given its own sort of massive set of risks that is something that we look at from an industry to provide insurance or reinsurance for. So it's something that's, you know, you see people being hacked these days, the NHS last month and so on. And I think I read in the paper today that the FCA, which regulates the insurance companies who are dealing direct with the public, they may, or banks, for example, may want them to actually disclose how many times they've been hacked, you know, in the last year, if you're thinking about joining them as a bank, or they're going to offer you a product, so that they can give you a benchmark of how secure their data is, which is quite interesting. Those great strides in technology have also led to different kind of risks in the world that we live in today. And it can be, you know, when we see the awful things that have happened recently, a lot of them are to do when the communications is all via technology. That's the downside of it, really. But that risk is transferred from one area into this area. Things, you know, I don't think... So it's how we look to... I don't want to use the word control, but it's how we understand the way technology can be used against us and to our detriment is something that I think we all need to be mindful of. I'm not quite sure how we manage it, by the way, or what we do about it. But I do think it's something that's opened us up to a whole new range of risks that affect businesses. You could take out the power grid. Somebody can hack in and take out the whole, you know, whole of Southeast England if they choose to. It's understanding those risks. So our industry is ever evolving, really. So we've kind of matched. One thing I love about it is that we've matched the pace of technological change, because we've actually considered the new risks as they've come along. And that's one thing about the business I enjoy, because it's actually quite creative for being a sort of, you know, what could possibly is often seen insurance, reinsurance, a very boring industry. There's some massively creative things that go on, and that's a real plus side of it. So while I love the technology, we should use it to our advantage, the downside, we have to manage that downside as a company, you know, from controls that we have in terms of of what we're able to do, you know, inside out to the company, how people might try and sort of hack us, etc. We have very strong controls, and that's one of our key strategies, is to minimize that risk as much as we can. We want zero risk in that area if we possibly can. So I think companies have to evaluate their risk differently while they embrace all these new possible ways of using technology.
Yeah, and I think that when you were talking about the insurance industry and what it's allowed things to do is, if the increased risk on a technology standpoint hasn't done anything, it's certainly given the ability of companies to actually become like a little bit more sexy,
Absolutely. Oh, we are way more sexy than we used to be. The insurance arena is now it's something that people, young people, looking to graduate from university or whatever, are actually coming and saying, what can you offer me? I like, because we've, as well as having the technological advances, we've hired people to actually then use that technology. So the risk management development has been huge. So natural catastrophe modelling changes have been massive. So the industry, and we've always had, sort of lawyers and accountants and so on, but there's slightly more sexier elements to it, operational risk management. It can be really interesting. And you get, we now, and that's a big change I've seen, is that we are now, rather than sort of being seen as a poor relation of other industries, it's actually being seen as quite sexy, because we do offer, we do work within a huge range of industries and different cover that we can offer that people don't always realise. But it is actually becoming more of an attractive marketplace to people to come and talk to us anyway. That's really been a big change, which is great, because then you get non-traditional people in then, and that's something that's fantastic.
Exactly. And it's like, it's disruption, isn't it? I think that this wave of kind of startups, out of Silicon Valley and stuff that have been like super disruptive, that's now what people are looking at. They're looking at these kind of less glam industries, if you like to call it, and seeing like opportunity. So yeah. I think it's a mentality shift as well when you see companies like Uber and Airbnb and stuff who've been like super disruptive in their particular spaces, like taxiing. When was that ever a sexy industry to get involved in? But like now you look at insurance and you look at the recruitment space we're in. It's like I was attracted to recruitment from a startup background, and people were like, why are you get interested in that? And I was like, because it's like the opportunity for kind of disruption, the opportunity to do different things is so vast that it's exciting. Like, that's an exciting thing to do. Like, I've worked on blank canvas projects before and they're amazing and I enjoy blank canvas. But then you look at, other industries where there's an opportunity for change and disruption, that's a new challenge, and that's something that is now just as exciting for people. So people are like, it binds well for the older industries like insurance and finance and stuff as well, because people want to go there with the absolute intent of being creative. So it's definitely bringing that together, and I think that that's very much stemmed from the successes of various startups and the disruptive tendencies and the ability to be disruptive with technology as well.
Yeah, no, that's definitely right. And so, and as I was saying, it's I've always viewed it as a creative industry, but nobody, it's not something that necessarily is the first word that people would use about it. But anything that, anything that happens within our lives, or companies or new products or something, this industry looks to develop a product that enables that people to buy, to actually then take that business and take it forward, and we will provide backing for that business. We will provide the security and the cover for them to do that, and hopefully they're successful. So for anything new that comes along, we would look to, not just my company but others, would look to provide a product that supports that company going forward. And it's really creative, and we will cover anything, generally speaking. There's nothing that's sort of, we would look to consider, if people have a new product or a new line of business that they wish to go into, we would look to see, can we support them and provide them with reinsurance and help them offset their risk in some way. So it is very creative, and I love that about it, really. You know, and we cover so many areas. I mean, I used to work in the past, and though it never made any money because it's an area that was always very difficult, but we had something called contingency insurance, which is film financing. So when I was starting out in this industry, I used to get to read film scripts and assess them for risk, and you know, and it's just an element that you never consider necessarily that is something that insurance, you know, reinsurance, insurance, Lloyd's, whatever it is, however you want to term it, actually looks at things like that. But everything that we do requires some kind of cover and risk mitigation, and that's what we provide. And that's a huge playing field to work with, really. It's cool. But we do try to match, you know, innovation, you know, the technological innovation, people's thinking, the way they want to approach something. We will actually look to try and support them and help them manage their risk exposures. So that's what we do, and it's very creative, and I think that attracts a lot of people into to the market these days, because it's much more visible about how it is being creative. And I think that's a sort of knock-on effect on having technology in our interconnected world. It's much easier to communicate that out to people. You know, whether you follow people on LinkedIn or Instagram or whatever it might be, you can see what people are doing. And we share information now, you know, intellectual information about, we might write a paper about latest farming techniques or something, you know, whatever it might be. And we will distribute that as a paper that people are free to read and look at. So that sharing of information is really cool as well.
I agree. I think that that's kind of what we, you know, done now with all the various outlets and platforms now, is the availability of information is there. And that's something that I think has been one of the most exciting things over the last 10 years, I think, that has you know, come at the forefront and allowed businesses to, you know, obviously share their message and, you know, and use it as not just a pure marketing tool, but also like for, you know, a recruitment hiring process to understand, like, you know, what kind of the incentives are, what's there, what is it all about? You know, I think that's all been part of kind of this latest generation. I think that, like you say, when you look at insurance companies, they kind of need that to be able to kind of share their message and explain like that it's maybe beyond, you know, just an inconvenience that people have to do, I suppose, you know. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, and how, you know, sort of like when you look at, you know, you turn on your TV or you're Twittering, you get the adverts come through, or whatever, it's that opportunity that very sort of slightly boring elements of an industry have never had, you know, being able to interact directly with your client base like that. If you're looking at, you know, motor insurance, homeowners, whatever it might be, Prudential, whoever, Aviva, you know, these, you know, Admiral, you know, that they provide you with an instantaneous snapshot of what they think their culture is and what kind of company they are, and you form your opinions by what you see. I think these days as well. Whereas before, you know, it was given to you, you know, back in the day, somebody would knock on your door and offer you, you know, your life insurance cover. And those days have long gone. And now, I think as consumers, we make instant choices about how something looks when it comes across our screen, whether we're on Facebook or whatever, and you get those annoying adverts that come across every so often. Sometimes you think, oh yeah, okay, that looks pretty good. But you form an instant sort of evaluation about what that company is and its culture and what it's going to give you and why you feel that you want to go with them. It's not something that it can appeal to very visually and sort of viscerally to you these days. And that's something that we've never been able to do as an industry before. It's a big step about how we can approach people. So yeah, but we don't do that because we don't deal with the general public or, you know, sort of on that personal lines basis. But we, you know, companies from a corporate perspective can also offer a cultural view of themselves from their websites, from the things they might publish, what they put through their Twitter and their LinkedIn feeds. And we make that choice with our communications departments about, you know, what kind of look and feel we want to portray as a company that reflects our culture. And that goes a long way, I think, these days, when you're looking at millennials and whoever, as to creating an impression about a company that they really want to come and join. You know, are we innovative? Are we providing some interesting research stuff out there? How do we look? You know, and I think it creates, because I think young people these days want to come work somewhere that has a that has some meaning around the company, if you see what I mean. I think that there is a strong corporate element, social responsibility element that people look for these days, actually. I think people have come out thinking, who do I want to work for and why do I want to work for them? And what is it that I like about them as a company? It's something that I think young people, if they're going to give up their time and have to spend time in an office, they want it to be in an environment and with a company that appeals to them on a much more granular level than it perhaps did to me when I was looking for roles when I first started out.
I like that. For me as well, it's interesting how, like, the dynamics of what we've kind of talked about. But for you personally, just to kind of round things off, like, you know, how have, priorities changed for you? And, you know, I think that it's an interesting question on the basis of, work dynamics, how priorities have changed their life, how priorities change. But for you personally, and we know that, like, the generations, their priorities are different as well. But for you, I suppose, just to broadly, have they changed a lot, or have they always kind of remained pretty consistent?
That's a very interesting and rather difficult question to answer, actually, because I'm having to think about it. It's one that, priorities and sort of work, the work time and dynamics have certainly changed. And one thing that I have come to value, but that's probably at the point where I am in my career, and I think it's good if you can do it earlier in your career, is actually I think quite often I've not been focused enough on what my work priorities should be, because I think when you I don't want to be to gender to sort of throw a gender element into this, but I might have to. But it is meant from a practical perspective. It's that, you know, as a woman and have always worked, and I have a son, etc. And there are times when it's been easier to work and less easy to work, but that desire to work, that work ethic has always been extremely strong. What I probably haven't done enough is focus on what steps I should take as I've gone through my career and prioritise those. I find now I spend the time that I do spend on prioritising work and what's important to me is not time wasted. I think there is sometimes a view that luxury of time about considering your next career move, what your CV should look like, whatever it is along those sort of priorities about what you want to achieve out for your career, is not time wasted. It's time well spent. And you can do that thinking anywhere, really. So I wish I'd spent more time understanding what my work priorities were as I went through my career. Now, I think my priorities at work if I have an ability to influence my company in the way we view young people, the way we want to hire people, understand better inclusion and diversity, then that's something that I do spend some time on, and I'm involved in sort of stuff outside of work in various groups, etc., that look to try and focus on that and promote our industry and also to have those aspects have a positive effect on our industry and embrace, you know, different kinds of people and with different sets of skills that might look at life very differently. So I think that's something that I, as a work priority, is important to me, that I'm able to give some time back to that now. Is quite important and sort of be a bit more vocal about it. In terms of work dynamics, I think the change has been massive, actually, over the last 15, 20 years. It's just, but then you change your views as you mature through your career and you get older and different things become important to you. It's important to me now to work for a company that chimes with my values. My company is a French headquartered, it's a French company. I've been here for 7.5 years, and it's been thoroughly enlightening and hugely rewarding working for a company that at its heart is French. we have a lot in common with them, more than we perhaps might think. From and then from a global perspective, I have colleagues in also many different places. And so this is the first global company I've worked for. I've always worked previously for businesses based within the city, most likely within Lloyd's of London as a specialist market. So this is my first, and I've really enjoyed that wider aspect of getting to understand and getting to have exposure to different cultures and colleagues in different areas. And working for a French headquartered company is just, it's fantastic. It's very different. And the emphasis is placed on different things. And it's, I really enjoy that. I really enjoy working for a non-UK company. I'm not saying that I've never worked for a UK company again, but it is very pleasurable to work for a company after, you know, 20 odd years in the market of working just for UK companies, to work for a company that is different. And it's very hard to put your finger on it sometimes, but it's that culture in there. So it's been around for 40 years, ex-state company. It's got some interesting cultural dynamics going on. But at heart, it's a really, the DNA of the company is just lovely. That's not a word that you use very often, but, you know, it can be frustrating at times. But the DNA of the company is really fantastic. And it's I value that. So if I was looking to do something else and move on somewhere else, that element of what the culture of a company is, you know, how does it care for its staff? You know, what do colleagues feel about it? It's something that would be very important to me. More so than the actual, whereas I think when you're younger as well, you're often driven by money and circumstances and necessities, etc., that it's not always practical to be able to find a company that meets all of those needs. But that sort of cultural comfort aspect of it going forward for me as a you know, a work priority is pretty high on my list. That answers your question. I'm not sure it does.
No, it does. It does beautifully. It does wonderfully, should I say. So thank you for that, Karen. And I have absolutely enjoyed everything we've discussed today. And I hope you have too.
I really have.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud. Or check out the website, venturi-group.com. And keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.